Hey everyone, and welcome to the Linux and Open Source News Show. I'm your host, Nick, and this is a podcast where we discuss everything related to Linux, open source, privacy, the open web, everything along those lines. And this week, we've got a bunch of stuff. We've got the final Cosmic Alpha before the beta starts. We've got Fedora submitting a proposal to drop X11 packages entirely for their GNOME edition. We've got OpenAI maybe wanting to buy Chrome if Google is forced to sell it off as part of the recent antitrust lawsuits they are facing. We've got a gigantic progress report on GNOME's STF project. We've got NVK now supporting a lot of older NVIDIA GPUs, and a lot more. So as always, if you want to learn more about any of these topics, you know where to go. All the links are in the show notes. And if you want to support the show, all the links to do that are in the show notes as well, including links for our sponsor, Tuxedo Computers. If you've been listening to this show or watching any of my videos, you know about Tuxedo Computers. They make laptops and desktops that ship with Linux out of the box. They have a pretty big range that will fit every price point and every need. They're based in Germany, but they ship to most countries in the world. They have tons of keyboard layouts to choose from, and you can even add your own custom one. You can have your own custom logo engraved on the lid of your laptop, and they have plenty of different components you can pick from and plenty of different models. If you want reviews, my YouTube channel has plenty of those as well. I only use Tuxedo Computers these days. Everything I do related to Linux is done on one of their laptops. Everything I do related to gaming is done on one of their desktops. I don't even have a computer that is not from Tuxedo these days. So if you want to learn more about them, or if you need a new computer and you want to support a company that actively contributes to Linux, you can click the link in the show notes or in the description of the video and get a Tuxedo laptop or desktop. They're really, really good. So if, like me, you were hyped about the potential of having Google be broken up by the US Department of Justice, potentially being forced to sell Chrome, you might turn around real quick on that, because OpenAI now says that they would buy Chrome if Google was forced to sell it off. Since Google has been found to violate antitrust laws, they might end up having to sell parts of their business. And Chrome seems to be the one that is most likely to be sold, Android second, if that, of course, ever happens at all. The issue is, if they have to sell parts of their business, then someone is going to buy parts of that business. And there are some other terrible actors for the web out there, not just Google, including AI companies. Nick Turley, ChatGPT's chief at OpenAI, said that they could offer a really incredible experience where OpenAI could have the ability to introduce users into what an AI-first experience looks like, which does not sound good at all to me. He also said that they currently have very powerful competitors who control the entry points on how consumers access AI tools. They're probably referring to Google's payments to other companies to pre-install Gemini on Android phones everywhere, or the self-preference. Manufacturers generally give their own apps and solutions inside their own operating systems or app stores. As an example, Google reportedly pays Samsung enormous sums of money each month to have Gemini pre-installed on Samsung devices. That's a 2-year agreement that is precisely what Google was condemned for in the past, using their dominant position in the smartphone market to strike deals and to win even more market share in other markets, the very definition of abusing your dominant position. And honestly, I'm a bit split on this one, because on the one hand, I'm very happy to see these big tech companies being checked and maybe even in the future be broken up. They have far too much control over far too many important parts of the internet or just digital ecosystems in general. But on the other hand, having those parts of a business sold off to really unsavory companies like OpenAI or any other potential big tech company, because if Google sells off Chrome, who's to say it's not, I don't know, Oracle buying it or Microsoft or whoever else, that would also kind of suck. So I'm really torn. I don't really know what to think on this. Now, this week, Cosmic got yet another alpha, Alpha 7. But apparently, this time, it's really the last one before the beta. They added the ability to interact more with workspaces, including moving them around, switching between a fixed number of workspaces, or automatically creating new workspaces when you need a new one, naming those workspaces, pinning them to the list, basically just better workspace organization. Accessibility also has been improved quite a lot with a high contrast mode, with color filters for color blindness, color inversion, or the ability to switch to mono sounds to help people who have difficulty hearing from one ear or the other. Tooltips have been added in various places as well to add some instructions and some information, and they also added support for handling global system-wide keyboard shortcuts, although they are not using the modern keyboard shortcuts portal that everyone else uses. For now, they developed a sort of midway implementation where you can choose a few options for X11 apps, because Cosmic uses Wayland, of course, and so when you're running those X11 apps, you can grant them the permission to have those global shortcuts or not. It is off by default because it is less secure than the actual keyboard shortcuts portal. Fractional scaling is also improved with basically two modes, one that is optimized to scale applications, so less blurriness and crisper rendering, and one that is optimized for video games or full screen content, where you basically let the full screen app regulate the scaling that you use. You also now have type ahead search in the file manager, so you can start typing a few letters on your keyboard and it will automatically filter the view with what you're searching for. You can change the left or right balance for speakers, and plenty of bugs were fixed as well. There's also added support for more Wayland protocols, there's performance improvements, and a lot of smaller touches and features all around the desktop. Now, I'm thinking once Cosmic has a stable version, I might just move to it as my daily driver, because I love KDE, I know it really well. I also love GNOME, I also know it really well. I used it for a long, long while, but Cosmic seems like it strikes that good balance between number of features, customization, but also not being completely overcrowded with things like KDE can be at some time. So maybe I'll just move to it as my daily driver for a few months and see how I like it. That will also allow me to have a really well-informed opinion on it and add it to my repertoire of desktop environments that I learn how to use. Now, the end is nigh for X11 support on GNOME, at least in Fedora. A proposal for Fedora 43 has been submitted to remove support for X11 entirely on the GNOME edition of the distro, meaning only Wayland will be available as a session, and GNOME X11 related packages will not be included in Fedora's repos. Users that use GNOME with X11 on Fedora would be transparently migrated to a Wayland session instead. And this seems to echo GNOME's wish to completely remove X11 support in GNOME 50. So not the next version, but the one that lands next year in April. They're going to start disabling X11 support at the compiler level for GNOME 49, and they're going to start to uproot X11 code entirely, starting with GNOME 50, meaning there shouldn't really be any way to run GNOME on X11 in a year, unless someone forks and maintains that GNOME fork themselves. Since no one really will be dedicated to fix those X11 bugs on GNOME or to add new features to X11, the people behind the Fedora proposal feel like it's safer to just ditch X11 entirely. Now, X11 apps will still run on Wayland using X-Wayland. They're not removing that at all. And people who absolutely need X11 can move to another spin, another desktop, like Plasma, Cinnamon, Mate, or anything else. Now, as always, this is a proposal, so it has to be accepted by the Fedora Steering Committee. They will decide if this is enacted or not, but I don't see GNOME moving back and reintegrating X11 more into the desktop, so at some point, Fedora and virtually every other distro using GNOME will just have to do without an X11 session. Now, Plasma is taking the same route, but they did say that they would keep X11 support alive until Plasma 7, which will likely not release before 5, maybe 6 years, I would wager, so you're safer on that desktop. At some point, though, all desktops will have dropped X11, because no one really wants to work on that. Now, speaking of GNOME, they published a really long blog post detailing all the work they've done on the Sovereign Tech Fund projects. This includes Newton, their new accessibility framework that is built to work with DBus and with a new Wayland protocol, so accessibility tools can work within sandboxed applications as well. All of that work is already integrated in a fork of GNOME OS and the GNOME Flatpak runtimes, so it's ready to be tested and potentially ready for inclusion when it is tested enough. Orca, the screen reader, was also modernized to have a much more legible code base, and the way developers can make their app legible by Orca has been improved as well, with actual documentation to explain how that works. There's also some work done on LibertVita thanks to the STF, notably with Bottom Sheets, a little widget that provides a little page that slides up the bottom and can be swiped down to close it. You also have adaptive dialogues that resize properly on all screen sizes. You have multi-layout views, meaning the app can change how it looks depending on the window width or size. There are toggle groups that present various options in the same widget instead of having separate icons or a drop-down menu. In short, it is a lot of work on the GNOME graphical library to make better apps. Another project is the Notifications API, letting any app describe the icon, header, text, text formatting, buttons, and alert sounds that they want, and then any desktop is able to render this as a native notification that looks right at home on that desktop. V2 of this Notifications API is complete, and V3 already has a list of planned features. And in GNOME, all of that work has already landed in GNOME 48 and will keep going in GNOME 49 and GNOME 50 for the next versions of the API. Global keyboard shortcuts were another STF project. It landed in GNOME 48. And there were also improvements to the XDG desktop portals. They now handle USB devices and they have better documentation. Among other things, there was the Nautilus file chooser portal that we saw in GNOME 47, I think, more work on GNOME online accounts, more language bindings, more work on GNOME OS to try and make it into an actual full-featured operating system for developers, not just a very limited testbed. There's some work on immutable tooling as well, on a GNOME OS installer, on home directory encryption, which is completed but not merged yet, plus hardware-accelerated screen recordings that we've seen already, support for X-Wayland fractional scaling, variable refresh rate, better performance in GNOME Shell, and more. All that work that we've seen starting with GNOME 46 all the way to GNOME 48. At the time GNOME got this 1 million euro grant, I distinctly remember a lot of people saying that it just wasn't enough to compete with giant tech companies and what they could accomplish with a lot more funding and money, but judging what they've been able to accomplish with this 1 million euro grant, not only for GNOME but for the entire Linux desktop ecosystem, it is clear that an open source project that has a lot of its management operations be volunteer driven and just has to pay developers, not shareholders, not middle managers, it is clear that an open source project does a lot more with 1 million euros than a tech company ever would, because they've done an insane amount of work. Now, they will apparently apply for another STF grant to keep going on all that work. I do hope that they get it. I do hope that we get more funding and more money injected in those big, important open source projects so everyone can benefit. Now, on Linux, we are generally pretty safe from apps turning incompatible with our older systems. We can generally keep using older distros for a long while before software stops working, especially thanks to Flatpaks and other formats like that. But there is still a cutoff point, and Steam reached that point. Starting August 15, distributions using glibc in a version older than 2.31 will be dropped by Steam. They simply won't be able to run the Steam client or any games anymore. This version is still found apparently in Debian 10, in Ubuntu 18.04, in Linux Mint 19, in Red Hat Enterprise Linux 7 and 8, in Fedora 31, and more. Basically, 5, 6, 7-year-old distros still rely on that version. It is likely that these distros are mostly used on servers, and they are not really affected by Steam dropping them. I'm sure that if these distros have a recent enough version of Flatpak, you could still use the Steam Flatpak on them, because it probably comes with its own runtime and likely its own version of glibc in one of those Flatpak runtimes, but native packages for Steam for sure won't work anymore. Of course, if you use any of these older distros as your desktop, unless you really can't, you should upgrade to a newer version. These distros, the desktop environments they run, and the versions of the libraries they run have progressed a lot in terms of features and performance in the past 5 or 6 years. So really, for desktops, you should use something that is not older than a year or thereabout. Now, we have some good news for open source graphics drivers. First, NVK is now Vulkan 1.4 conformant on Maxwell, on Pascal, and on Volta GPUs. So anything from a GTX 745 all the way up to the current RTX GPUs are supported with this driver, meaning the open source Vulkan driver that runs on top of the Nouveau kernel driver, or in the future on top of the Nova driver being developed by Red Hat, well, this now supports a lot of NVIDIA cards, not just the very latest. Now, they want to have NVK enabled by default for all these cards in Mesa 25.1, so in May, and the OpenGL drivers these cards use will be replaced by Zynq, which basically uses Vulkan to render OpenGL stuff in Mesa 25.2. For older GPUs, they might get support at some point. The work has already started on that, but they are not giving any specific time frame because there is a lot of work to do. Fermi cards might not be supported at all though, so cards from a GeForce 410M all the way to a GT730 or 820M, these are apparently a lot trickier to get to work with Vulkan, so no guaranteed support on that one. Still, that is pretty fantastic news. I was afraid that that open source stack would leave behind a lot of users from older cards and it would just support RTX or the very last GTX cards, but it looks like they really want to support most of the stuff that NVIDIA released for the past 7, 8, or 9 years. So that's actually pretty good. And I can't wait to test drive this driver and to actually be able to use it in daily use, because I do have an NVIDIA GPU on the laptop I'm using to record this on Linux. Now, Ubuntu is moving forward with their plan to replace some of their core utilities with Rust-based versions. In Ubuntu 25.10, a bunch of the GNU core utilities will be replaced by Rust core utils to make sure that they can test things ahead for Ubuntu 26.04. And I'm sure a bit of testing will not hurt, especially when you look at the recent Ubuntu releases. They had upgrade-breaking bugs, notably on Kubuntu, so testing these core utilities before shipping them in an LTS is probably a good idea. Now, these Rust-based utilities are a bit larger than the GNU ones, and when I say a bit, I mean a lot. They are 25 megabytes compared to the 7 megs the GNU utils take. So that's really a big jump in disk space and disk image size, to the point that a Docker image for Ubuntu would jump about 24% in size. And so they're probably going to stick to the GNU core utils. And if you're wondering what these utilities are, they are your core command line programs. They're chown, chmod, cp, dd, ln, ls, make, dir, move, rm, cat, all the stuff that you might use in script or that just make GNU the operating system layer on top of the Linux kernel. Which also means that at some point, maybe people will call it Rust/Linux instead of GNU/Linux, because if you replace that GNU layer by Rust-based utils, it's no longer GNU/Linux. Now, I looked online, there doesn't really seem to be a strong rationale for replacing the GNU core utils with the Rust core utils. They're not necessarily faster. The GNU core utils don't really have big security vulnerabilities or don't generally are vulnerable to a lot of things. There aren't many CVEs reported against them, so the Rust advantage on that front isn't really that important. And they are bigger than the GNU core utils. What I found is that basically this could be used as a test drive to see how Ubuntu can integrate more Rust-based tools inside the distro so they can then move more significant parts of the OS to Rust-based tools instead. But apart from that, there doesn't really seem to be a good reason. There's also the move from these Rust core utils to the MIT license when the GNU core utils are under the GPL. Some people think that MIT license is just not restrictive enough. There's a lot of online discussion, which for once doesn't seem to center around the fact that those tools are using Rust specifically, so that's a nice change. It looks like Linux keeps beating Windows in benchmarks on new CPUs. Foronix did a run of their test suite on the AMD Ryzen AI 7 Pro, a very recent CPU plus integrated GPU combo from AMD, and Ubuntu 25.04 gets 9% better scores on average than Windows 11 on the exact same hardware, namely a Lenovo ThinkPad T14s Gen 6. Foronix compared the pre-installed Lenovo Windows 11 with all its patches and updates to Ubuntu 25.04 beta from early April using the kernel 6.14 and Mesa 25.0. And Ubuntu arrived first in 85% of the tests, 68 out of the 80 that they conducted. And that includes both GPU and CPU-related testing. This is along the lines of most of these types of tests on new hardware. Linux tends to beat Windows by about 10% on average, whether it's due to a bloated pre-installed Windows 11 or just due to Linux being lighter and more optimized. The fact remains, for most people, a Linux install will yield more out of the same device than a Windows install. And that is no small feat, because this is Windows we're comparing ourselves to. This is the default manufacturers write their drivers for. Now, imagine if manufacturers focused all the efforts that they put on Windows drivers, but for Linux drivers instead. Imagine all the efficiency gains, the energy saved, and generally just the better performance everyone would have on their computers. That would be insane. Still, another win for Linux, always nice to see. Now let's talk about the internet a little bit. Google apparently decided not to drop third-party cookies support inside of Chrome. They had offered various solutions in the past that were just not really satisfactory for most actors of the online ads ecosystem, mostly because they would have made Google Ads far better at targeting users than any other solution that couldn't have access to that much first-party data. Google had ended up saying that they would implement a pop-up for users in Chrome to choose whether they wanted to keep using cookies or if they wanted Google's solution called the Privacy Sandbox. And obviously, people would have picked the Privacy Sandbox because it's new and it's called Privacy Sandbox, where everyone knows that cookies are really invasive and everyone hates them because of all those cookie banners. Well, Google is now backing down on this. They will let users choose manually if they want to disable third-party cookies themselves or rely on the Privacy Sandbox instead. Now, again, this is a pros and cons situation. On the one hand, virtually every single browser apart from Chrome has disabled third-party cookies because they are super invasive. You can visit a website. If you click accept all without really reading, you could get a lot of your browsing data stored by your website. And when you visit that website, well, it can access it and store it in their database and sell access to it without your knowledge, because who reads those cookie notifications? No one. On the other hand, if Chrome replaces those cookies with their own Google-made solution, it means that all of a sudden, 80% of the world that uses Google Chrome doesn't send any browsing or personal data to any website anymore, apart from what Google collects and accepts to send them through the Privacy Sandbox. Meaning all the ad networks become less efficient than Google's, and Google wins a virtual monopoly on online ads. Neither solution feels good to me, really. Now, to conclude, we have yet another lawsuit against OpenAI, this time by the owner of CNET, PCMag, and IGN. Of course, for the same reasons everyone else sues OpenAI or AI companies, which is alleged copyright infringement. Ziff Davis, he's the owner of all of these outlets and a lot more, he says that OpenAI trained their AI models on the content of his websites, even though the robots.txt files of these websites told the OpenAI crawler not to crawl them or read the content. Now, the guy is no small fish. He has 45 media brands, he employs 3,800 employees, he is probably one of the biggest publishers to sue OpenAI at this point. So the suit alleges that OpenAI copied, reproduced, and stored the work of all the outlets Ziff Davis owns, and that it used that work to create responses in ChatGPT. Ziff Davis also apparently identified hundreds of full copies of the text of some articles of his websites, Now, as always, OpenAI says that they use public data, that it all falls under fair use, which I would argue it really doesn't, because fair use assumes no financial harm is done to the original content creator, and I don't see how OpenAI either completely copying or completely paraphrasing content at such a massive scale doesn't harm content creators. There have been a lot of lawsuits against OpenAI, but also a lot of other AI companies. At some point, one of them will be litigated and we'll at least know in the US what the US justice thinks of this. Is it fair use? Is it not fair use? And the rest of the world can also start litigating those things because these lawsuits aren't just happening in the US. What I hope will happen is that AI companies are just forced to license the content, to pay the creators, to have a right to use their content to train their model on. I don't think it is fair use to bypass robots.txt files and paraphrase the entire internet at that massive scale. But of course, I'm no lawyer, I'm no judge. What I fear will happen is that these companies will be far too ingrained in today's society by the time this is litigated, and so they will either just have the money to shrug any fine or any problem, like all the big tech companies in the world right now, or we just will have to litigate in their favor because doing otherwise would break the entire world. I hope we don't land on that, but I'm afraid that's what's gonna happen because it's taking way too long to actually go through with these lawsuits these days. Anyway, this will conclude today's episode. I hope you enjoyed listening to it. As always, if you want to dive deeper into any of these topics, all the links are in the show notes, and all the links to support the show and or to look at our sponsor, Tuxedo Computers, they're also in the show notes. So thanks for listening, and I guess you'll hear me in the next one next week. Bye!